present.
Do we have a witness list? Witness.
I'm going to hear the testimony on the amendments to 2004, but then I want to talk to you before we have to do them, so I think I'll reschedule that again for Wednesday so we can talk about the amendments.
Okay. The governor's office has some interest in issues on it. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Okay. Let's... By protocol, we usually try to make it easy on the legislators, and we also have the good labor commissioner here today. Welcome, labor commissioner. Why don't we have, we got four legislators and three seats. Why don't you guys go out and shoot it out? No.
Three legislators.
All right, three legislators. Would you explain what the bill does, please, Mark?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 783 requires employers to provide an unpaid rest period for employees to breastfeed or express milk if providing this rest period does not cause undue hardship on the operation of an employer's business.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I represent Senate District 18. I'm going to keep my comments very short because I want to allow the people in the audience who actually brought breastfed babies to the hearing to have a chance to testify. Actually, I'm kind of the second best person to be here from my household. The best person would be my 15-year-old daughter who is in the Capitol today. But unfortunately, I'm to my great surprise, I couldn't persuade her to sit up beside me and vouch for the benefits of being a breastfed child. So
that would be a duh.
Thank you, Mrs. Like I say, I was totally stunned to hear this news. But she will show you that breastfed children are so much healthier for being breastfed, and anything we can do as a society to encourage that, and especially to encourage mothers who are breastfeeding to continue even when they have to go back to work.
But Senator Burdick, didn't you tell me that your daughter is studying things like women's liberation movement and political science and stuff? Why is she such a good example of breastfeeding?
Well, I must admit they do turn out a little bit independent, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm very pleased to be joined here by Representative Ackerman, who's also a chief co-sponsor of this, and Representative Diane Rosenbaum, who's going to speak on its behalf from the Women's Health and Wellness Coalition. So I will turn it over to Representative Ackerman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Corcoran, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Ackerman. I'm a state representative representing House District 13. My testimony is in support of this bill. Senate Bill 783 requires an unpaid rest period for mothers to breastfeed or express milk, provided that the activity does not cause an undue hardship on the employer. The following are the benefits which result from this bill. First, nursing mothers can return to the job market more quickly. And secondly, breastfeeding is promoted and will result in better nutrition and health for infants. It should be relatively easy for any employer to make a reasonable effort to provide room or private location for this activity. The employer is not required to provide a rest period if it would impose an undue hardship on the operation of the employer's business. This bill is supported by a majority of the Senate and House of Representatives, and should be referred to the Senate with a do-pass recommendation by this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative for House District 42, and I'm appearing today as co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. As you know, the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance is a broad coalition of advocates and organizations on issues affecting women's health and economic well-being. And we're very pleased to be able, in our 10th anniversary year, to have Senate Bill 783 as one of the 9 bills in our package of legislation for this session. We believe that Senate Bill 783 is really the latest step in Oregon leading the way in acknowledging that families and workers are both integral parts of the workforce. And as you know, Oregon led the nation in having the first family-friendly legislation in terms of parental leave and family medical leave. And now today in Senate Bill 783, we are acknowledging the fact that women are indeed an integral part of the workforce, and women with children in particular are so. A third of mothers return to work within 3 months after giving birth, and two-thirds of mothers return to work within 6 months after giving birth. And because the American Association of Pediatrics recommends breastfeeding during the first 12 months of a child's life, we believe that providing an opportunity for employers to accommodate breastfeeding is really something that's a win-win for the health of our children who need that for their health care, for the health of our workforce, because we know that parents who don't have to worry about the needs of their children are more productive, and that that is also a benefit to their employers. So we think Senate Bill 783 has struck the proper balance between balancing the needs of kids, employers, and the parents who are those valued employees, and we urge you to support Senate Bill 783 and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I guess one question I'd have to any of the three of you is, I can kind of anticipate that, you know, there will be opposition to this bill from the business community, and I wondered if you might just take a second and talk about what you believe would be not causing undue hardship on operation in terms of the operation of an employer's business.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that comes up in this bill is, one of the objectives of this bill is to give nursing moms or moms who are expressing milk some other place besides a restroom to do that. Now, there might be cases in a business where there just simply is no other location available, no cubby holes, no conference rooms, or nothing available. And so the business would actually have to add on a room or something to accommodate that. That would be an undue hardship. Or if there were a type of business where maybe the break periods were had to be staggered in a certain way, or it would interfere with the flow of work, and they would have to change their processes in some way, then that could be an undue hardship. And, you know, those, when they happen, would I think they would be relatively rare. I think if people are creative, they can certainly come up with something that will accommodate everything.
Thank you. Thank you, folks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Commissioner Gardner, welcome to the committee. We could have used you the other day. We had a very unfriendly lawyer type up here that made a couple of us kind of angry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I have a couple of them in my employ, Senator. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, I've always said one thing about this job is you are surrounded by too many lawyers, but, you know, anyway. For the record, the Bureau of Labor and Industries is neutral on Senate Bill 783. However, as Commissioner, I'm certainly wholeheartedly in favor of it. There are a few, I think certainly have taken into consideration that there are 40,000 Oregon women who give birth every year, and the congressional record shows us that 60-70% of those women go back to work within the first 3 months, and that 88% of those women breastfeed their children. In the 1999 session, the legislature passed a bill that would require agencies to accommodate employees who are breastfeeding infants and expand their protection to the private sector. This is a logical next step. CMI even supported that back in 99 when I was here. There is one quick structural thing that we have on the bill, though, is that it does attach itself to Chapter 653, and as you can see, outlined in my written testimony, we feel that it would be better attached to Chapter 659, which currently has rest periods in it, which would be a more appropriate fit, as outlined through items A through E in my written testimony. One other quick item is that the Bureau does anticipate a fiscal impact of about $30,000 for investigations for this particular area. However, given the current fiscal climate, the Bureau is more than willing to absorb those costs. We would ask the committee simply to add a budget note to the Appropriate Ways and Means Committee that we review it by next biennium, so that we can see that if those do come about, that perhaps next biennium we could see some funding for that.
So let me get this straight. You come in neutral on the bill, and you want us to move it in statute. Is that a summary of your comments?
I said the Bureau is neutral. I'm in favor.
Okay, thank you. All right.
The Bureau, for the record, Senator, is always neutral on everything. The Commissioner never is.
That's good to know. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Corcoran. Never thought I'd say that. Thank you.
There's some people in this room never thought I should have a gavel.
And it's good to see my senator over here, too.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You're living in my district now. Good. I like that.
Okay, we're going to close this public hearing for just a moment. Let me talk about a few process points here. Number one, if you're here for Senate Bill 571, we're not going to hear it today. So you can leave. You have the afternoon off. We are going to move to Senate Bill 724 work session right now. We have an amendment ready that the work group has come to agreement on, so we'll move that, and then we'll get back to the Senate Bill 783. So with that, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 724. Mr. Perry, you're the author, apparently, so why don't you tell us what we got?
For the record, Bill Perry is the Oregon Restaurant Association author. Might be a stretch, but I'm the one bringing forward the amendments. Looking at Senate Bill 724-2 amendments, what this does, it allows a 45-day comment period for local governments. Is expanded from 30 for new licenses. The renewals is returned to 60 days where it was previously. The only change from the date specific on the original bill is in Section 3 for some of the new licenses, which is mostly off-premise licenses. They get a 90-day temporary. If for some reason this makes it so OLCC cannot complete their investigations within the 90-day temporary, it allows the director to extend a temporary license another 30 days, and it basically says that if the commission acts on it, that has bearing. But if it's a commission-approved license, they can extend it 30 days. So, and I, as of right now, I've heard the cities are okay with this, and everybody that I've spoken to is okay with it.
Okay. So. Any questions? Seeing none. Anybody else wishing to testify on this? Seeing none. Entertain a motion.
We're in work session, right?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 724.
Senator Menace moves adoption of the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 724. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chairman.
Senator Menace.
Now move Senate Bill 724 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a defense recommendation.
Senator Menace moves Senate Bill 724 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mr. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Jeff Corcoran?
Aye. All right. Senate Bill 724 is on its merry way to the floor. Any carriers? I'll carry it then. Thank you. We'll close that work session. And I should have given it to Senator Walker, huh? She's not here. And we'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 783. And we won't do a work session on 783 today, since we'll be awaiting an amendment that Commissioner Bureau of Labor and Industries discussed earlier.
Gardner.
Yes, how quickly we forget their names once they leave the legislature. Okay. I'm going to have you folks come up in threes. Cynthia Good, Majab, Kate DeHolmes, and Danelda Dotson. I probably butchered two out of three of those names. Yes. The babies will be asked to identify themselves for the record. Welcome.
Thank you.
Who's going to start? Why don't we have Cynthia?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cynthia Good Mojab. I live at 352 Southeast 58th Court in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm a mother, breastfeeding advocate, author, educator, research associate in the publications department of La Leche League International, La Leche League leader, and international board certified lactation consultant. I'm very pleased to be here today. Infant feeding is a major health, environmental, economic, and political issue. My testimony is just a small excerpt from our current wealth of research demonstrating the importance of protecting breastfeeding mothers in the workplace. Formula feeding poses many risks to the health of mothers and children in both developed and developing countries. Formula-fed children, for example, have a higher incidence of SIDS, juvenile diabetes, ear infections, allergies, obesity, heart disease, and childhood leukemia. Mothers who formula feed have higher rates of breast and ovarian cancer, anemia, and osteoporosis. The health care costs of formula-fed infants are substantially higher than those of breastfed infants. Because of the risks of formula feeding, the objectives of Healthy People 2010 include increasing rates of breastfeeding initiation and duration. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends at least 1 year of breastfeeding, and the World Health Organization recommends at least 2 years of breastfeeding. In addition to increasing health risks and health care costs, formula feeding produces significant amounts of solid waste and uses valuable resources. The production, shipping, preparation of formula requires large amounts of water, fuel, paper, glass, and rubber and plastic. People rarely hear about the risks and costs of formula feeding. Instead, they hear about the benefits of breastfeeding as though they are special perks above and beyond what mothers could want for themselves and their children. These benefits are measured against the poorer health outcomes of formula feeding, outcomes so common in the United States that they are now seen as the norm against which we measure health. In reality, breastfeeding is the foundation of biologically normal human health and development. A woman's decision not to breastfeed must be respected. Yet women can know the risks of formula feeding, want to breastfeed, and not breastfeed. When this happens, and it often happens, it's time to stop and ask, what is it about our society that is getting in the way of so many women breastfeeding? Decisions about infant feeding are embedded in a historical, cultural, economic, and political context. Many social barriers to breastfeeding exist, from misinformation to the unethical marketing of formula to workplace policies that force women to choose between making a living and breastfeeding their children. Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney documents how breastfeeding mothers are facing discrimination and harassment in U.S. workplaces. The story is no different here in Oregon. Mothers are at the mercy of workplace policies that vary across the state. I spoke at the Washington County WIC Breastfeeding Open House in Hillsboro last year. After my presentation, a young, pregnant Latina woman approached me. She'd heard that it was very difficult to continue breastfeeding while working outside the home. She needed to work and she wanted to breastfeed. She wanted to know how could she maintain her milk supply and store her milk if her employer wouldn't provide time and space for her to do so. Do women really have to choose between working outside the home and breastfeeding? Is it really so difficult for employers to provide support for breastfeeding mothers in the workplace? The answer is clearly no. Providing accommodations for breastfeeding mothers in the workplace is a win-win situation. Mothers who continue to breastfeed after returning to work miss less time from work because of illness in their infant and have shorter absences when they do miss work compared with women who do not breastfeed. Many companies have found supporting breastfeeding in the workplace to be very good business. Aetna Incorporated saved $1,435 in medical claims and 3 days of sick leave per breastfed baby. When women cannot breastfeed or express milk during the workday, milk supply is likely to decrease and premature weaning may occur. Mothers may develop painful swelling of the breasts, plugged milk ducts, breast inflammation and infection, necessitating medical care and bed rest. When employers provide women time and space in which to express their milk or breastfeed during the workday, they protect the health of breastfeeding mothers and their nurslings. When women continue to breastfeed after they return to work, they save their employers money. Everyone wins. Nearly 6 out of 10 mothers in America with a child under 1 year of age are employed in the workforce. These women want to do right by their children and their employers. Enactment of Senate Bill 783 would increase the incidence and duration of breastfeeding in Oregon, save employers money, and help change public opinion about breastfeeding. When barriers to breastfeeding are removed, women are enabled to make a significant contribution to human health and development, economic stability, and environmental protection. Please help pass this bill. Breastfeeding is too important not to. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Mr. Holmes.
Hi. Chair Corcoran, members of the General Government Committee, my name is Kate DeSalms. This is my son, Dylan Marino. I'm a working mother. My son is 8 months old. I pump daily at work to provide the best meal for him. I've been very lucky that I was able to take a full 3 month maternity leave, which is another issue that you should support. And we established an excellent nursing bond. I truly wish to have the ability to stay home with my son full time, but that was not possible, only because of economic reasons. I work for a small corporation that's been very flexible about me pumping at work. I began pumping in the building's public restroom. The restroom is used by approximately 40 people in my office, as well as several other offices in the building. The restroom was not clean enough for me to pump. If you don't understand how that might be, imagine eating your lunch in any public restroom that you frequent, and that's what I was doing. So I switched to a small break room in our office, and I didn't ask to do that. I just did it, and no one said a word. Everyone has been very supportive, and it worked out fine for my employer. There's been no problems there at all. So I'm able to pump in a clean place with minimal imposition. Senate Bill 783 can greatly help women who are less adamant than I. There's several other women who still pump in the public restroom of the building that I work in. And they realize that they could do it somewhere else, and they still don't. I think if the bill was passed, they would use that office. Stress can have a great impact on a woman's ability to pump successfully. A stressed-out mother will not be able to have their milk let down, and then they get worried about not pumping, so the baby doesn't have food. So then it's just a vicious cycle that never stops. So if you could pass this, it would help countless women. This will in turn make them working with their I've incorporated stress relieving techniques into my daily life to help with this problem, and I've been extremely lucky that I've never had to supplement my son's diet with formula. This bill would help women who have not been as lucky as I am. Thank you for your time. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much, Kate. Any questions, panel? Nope. Senator Minnis.
Your employer was willing to accommodate
Yes.
your issues. Mm-hmm. So help me understand where the problem is.
The problem, I work for a very small corporation, mortgage insurance company, and most women do not work in a situation like I do. I work 4 hours a day. I in an office with all women. I think the problem is for people who make less money than I do, who work at places like McDonald's. And even other corporations, there are large corporations who are not, like, say, if your boss is a man, and I was not the first woman in my office to pump at all. There's like 5 women that are pregnant right now that I work with. So it's a very pro-mother. I have a very good employer.
Just, Mr. Chairman, again, do you know of a specific case where a woman's been denied?
Yes.
Can you cite
this? This lady right there.
Okay. So someone who's going to testify.
She's not going to testify, unfortunately, but she has written you letters.
Okay.
But I think that I do know that it happens
okay.
for women.
Let me
it just hasn't happened to me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me ask you this question, because I'm when I get involved, and I signed on to the bill, but I'm looking at the construct of the language here, and I'm trying to apply this to my employment. I'm a detective in Portland Police Bureau.
Right.
And there are a lot of females who work in the patrol branch of the Portland Police Bureau. How do you see this bill applying to, say, a female police officer who's in uniform out in a patrol district? How would this even affect this person? And if so, how would you see the employer's requirement under this law?
Well, I don't know. I think that it's important for every employer to provide a situation. And you can pump in your car. There are batteries if it's a person who has a patrol car.
Do you have to have the baby with you, right?
To pump?
No. We're not, okay, I'm sorry. We're not breast. Help me. I don't understand this.
Pumping is
different.
You're not only male, you're Irish. So this is going to take a while.
I take involve a contraption.
That's all right.
You know how cows are pumped every day? Okay. Same theory.
I was born in the city, so.
I take a contraption with me to work. I plug it in. It's
okay.
Also battery operated.
Okay.
Do both breasts at the same time. It takes me about 5 minutes.
All right. So this is not a breastfeeding bill. You don't have the baby.
No, it's about pumping at work.
This is about, okay, taking care of a
It's not saying she needs 30 minutes to go drive to her baby and sit there for 20 minutes and drive back for 30 minutes. I can do it effectively within 15 minutes.
But it says relating to breastfeeding in the workplace, not relating to pumping.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that
we were worried that Senator Miller was going to get a hold of this bill and think that it was self-service.
Well, again, I don't know if the relating clause includes...
Chair Corcoran, I'm not sure what protocol is here, but I could maybe address something.
Sure, go ahead.
It's opening the option of either pumping or breastfeeding in the workforce. If you know, maybe your baby's in your corporate daycare and you'd like to take, instead of a pumping break, you'd like to walk down the hall to your baby in corporate daycare and breastfeed. Well, why not? So it's not precluding it, but it's not insisting that that be the form that it takes.
Mr. Chairman, what is the term express?
That can be done using an electric pump or a manual pump or even by hand expression. There's a technique. So
the term express milk
would imply the baby is not there.
Okay.
Getting milk out of the breast without the baby being there.
All right. Well, Mr. Chairman, and this is a technical question. The relating clause in the bill says relating to breastfeeding in the workplace. And then we have an expression in the bill, express milk, which is assumed to not have the child present, which means the child would not be feeding, which means that portion of the bill may not technically fit under the amending or the relating clause. This is a technical issue for how the legislature is constructed or how the legislative council wrote the bill. I don't know that portion of it fits, because if we're really talking about what's the expression again, express milk, and that's what we're trying to get to, as opposed to the child actually being present and the mother being capable of feeding the child, then it would clearly fit under the relating clause, and that's a different issue. That's why I guess when you said breast pumping, that's different than feeding. So now I'm really confused. Being Irish, I can do that easily.
Maybe we can, what we can do, Senator, is we're going to have amendments brought forward by Boley anyway. Maybe when Boley brings their amendments in, we'll have legislative counsel come in and talk to us about the relating clause issue.
Yeah, I would like to know because what we're really talking about here is the ability to do the breast pumping procedure, whatever you want to call it, with the child absent, and that's the intent of the bill. This in talking about breastfeeding really takes into account the situation where the child is actually present.
Right.
So that's two different things.
Well, the long-term goal is that the baby continues to breastfeed for, like, the worldwide average is like 5 years.
Right.
So Americans have a very unusual policy regarding breastfeeding.
We have a lot of unusual people. Short people didn't used to be cops either. So,
yeah.
And we're hell on tourism in this building, too. Yeah.
That was a relating cause issue.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, folks, very much. I guess we haven't heard from Donelda Dotson, who's going to be additive in her comments.
Additive. Yes. Chair Cochran and members of the committee, I'm Danelda Dodds, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health for the Department of Human Services. And I just am here to support Senate Bill 783 because we want to encourage women to be able to continue to breastfeeding. We know that Oregon has some of the highest rates of breastfeeding initiation, but we also know that after 6 months, this initiation rate goes down to like 46%. And for low-income women, it can go down to like 35%. So we're very supportive of efforts to encourage breastfeeding and for employers to be able to support a woman in her breastfeeding efforts. And in fact, in last session, there was an executive order that encouraged all state offices to provide a breastfeeding place for women for either pumping or for breastfeeding their babies. Currently, we have 32 employers who support about 25,000 employees that are identified as breastfeeding-friendly employers, and that those employers range from employers who employ 3 people to those that employ as many as 11,000. So we're here to encourage this activity because it supports the health of moms and babies.
Thank you, Ms. Dodson. Yes, Senator Starr.
Question for the panel. Not sure necessarily who's best to address it to, but the length of time that is required to express, wouldn't that vary necessarily between women? It wouldn't be a constant amount. It wouldn't
Can
be a constant.
I answer that?
I'd throw it open to whom.
Yes, and it varies from person to person. It's highly related to stress. When I am having a bad time, I say at work, it takes a lot. Letdown is the physical. When you're pumping, it just doesn't come out. You have to have letdown, which is an endorphin release that allows your milk to actually come out of your body. It doesn't just come out because you want it to. And if you're very stressed out, it may not come out at all. And so I can do it, if everything's going well, in 5 minutes and get a full 8 ounces, which is more than adequate to supply him with food. But if I'm having a hard time, it might take me 15 minutes to get let down, which will in turn take me 20 minutes. And I'm very good at it. And there are women who have a lot harder time than that. And partly it's related to stress. So if your boss is not supportive and is not helping you by allowing you that time and privacy to do it, then you're going to have a hard time. So that's why this bill is so important.
You can imagine a woman who is trying to handle, I don't know if you've ever seen a breast pump, perhaps we should have brought one in so you'd know what we were talking about, but you have. All right, very good. You know, imagine trying to hold either one pump, there could be single or double, and you're in a bathroom stall, and people are coming in and out, and your motor is running. Everyone knows what you're doing. You have no privacy. You're in an uncomfortable location. You're in a bathroom, for Pete's sake, preparing your baby's meal. Imagine the stress of that experience, and yes, that stress could make the pumping take longer than it would have if someone had said, oh, sure, whenever you need a break, you can use that conference room. We don't use it at this time of day. That's going to work out just fine. Put the sign on the door. Put the lock, you know, lock the door, and you've got privacy. You've got a comfortable place. You've got your outlet right there, and there you go. So it's it does vary from one woman to woman, and it certainly does vary on the circumstances that you're trying to use that pump in.
Additional question.
Senator Starr.
As a woman continues to express over a period of time, does the length of time get longer or shorter as far as the time necessary to express?
Senator Starr, the answer to your question is that women who do use a pump, because it's a learning experience, often they figure out what it takes to get it to be efficient. They have a picture of their baby that helps them have that emotional experience that lets the milk let down and become available for the pump to take out. So the more experienced a woman is, generally the less time it takes her to pump. So in the beginning, a brand new mother who's adjusting to a pump, and she may already have begun that adjustment while home in preparation for going back to work, so she doesn't just start that first day. Over time, it may decrease. the letdown with breastfeeding, whether you're using a pump or breastfeeding a baby, generally becomes more efficient. Your body gets almost trained to the other cues. You think about your baby, and you might feel your milk let down. You hear a baby cry at the grocery store, and your milk might let down. So all of these kinds of things happen over time and with learning, and your body gets more ready to let down milk. So I would think on average, probably it does take less time as time goes by. In the beginning, there may be kind of a learning curve that a woman is trying to figure out. It certainly wouldn't increase on average because that learning curve is,
great,
is at work.
Thank you for that. I see we have my son here, too. I suppose he could come up and talk about the merits of breastfeeding. But he would be mortified if I even mentioned it, so I won't. Thank you, folks, very much. And now we will have Laura Nittel and Martha Johnson, please. If you have written testimony, what we usually recommend is that you don't read it verbatim into the record. We can read it and just tell us what your thoughts are. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chair Corcoran and members of the committee, my name is Laura Knittel. For the record, I live at 6111 Southwest 33rd Place in Portland, Oregon. I'm a mother, a breastfeeding peer counselor with Nursing Mothers Council of Oregon, and I also hold a PhD in neuroscience and work as a postdoctoral research associate at Oregon Health and Sciences University in Portland. And I'm very happy to appear before you today in support of Senate Bill 783. My daughter Marina is 2 years old now, and when Marina was born, I was working as a graduate research assistant at OHSU, and while I was writing my PhD thesis. I returned to work full-time when she was 10 weeks old, and I was committed to continuing to breastfeed her till at least when she turned 1 year old, because this is what the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends. Therefore, I decided to pump breast milk for her while I was at work so that I could provide bottles of breast milk to send to daycare with her, and I could also exclusively breastfeed her in the evenings and on weekends when I was with her. And I was able to pump for her until her first birthday, and I'm actually still breastfeeding her today, even though I no longer have to pump at work for her. And not very many women are able to accomplish what I did, and I wanted to tell you some of the factors that contributed to my success. And so my supervisor during this time was Dr. Carla Kent, and her support and understanding were keys to me being able to do this. First of all, Dr. Kent is the mother of two children, and she pumped breast milk for both of them till they were 1 year old. And she provided me with a private room to pump in that had a sink and a refrigerator. And the room that I used was actually a common use room. And we agreed that I would hang this sign on the door that says, "Do not enter, experiment in progress," so that people knew not to disturb me when I was in there. And the point I want to make with this is that new space did not need to be created for me. It was an existing space that I used. Another key element to my success was the fact that I had no qualms about telling her that it was time for me to go pump, because in her mind, this was a priority that I do this. And this is probably the most important thing that allowed me to pump milk for Marina until she was 1 year old. And I'd like to tell you that Marina's health has been exceptional. During the time that I was pumping milk for her, I actually only missed 2 days of work because she was too sick to go to daycare. And this is pretty amazing because Marina attends a group daycare center where illness is always prevalent. And actually, just 2 months ago, her daycare provider left this note on her daily chart, and I've provided a copy of it for you. And she wrote on it, "It's amazing how healthy Marina is compared to her peers. What do you do?" And I believe that my breast milk has been very important in contributing to Marina's excellent health. The fact that I haven't missed hardly any work due to her being ill has been a huge benefit to my employer. So women who are able to pump breast milk at work for their babies tend to be a lot like me these days. They're older and more educated. Women like me have the economic and intellectual power in the workplace to demand the time and space they need in order to pump. Many of these women have private offices of their own or are supervisors themselves, so they don't need to ask anybody's permission to take time. I feel strongly that women that don't have this type of power in the workplace should also be able to continue breastfeeding while working full-time. And I feel that Senate Bill 783 is a step in the right direction in order for this to happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Knittle. Any questions? Well, seeing none, do you have one?
Well, Ms. Chair, I was just going to comment. Ms. Knittle, we get sick here a lot in the Capitol because we recycle bad air. Maybe breast milk's what we need.
Not going there. Next question. Martha Johnson.
Chair Corcoran and committee members, my name's Martha Johnson. I live at 110 East Hilliard Lane in Eugene, and I'm a mother, a registered nurse, and I'm also an International Board Certified Lactation Consultant, and I'm the author of Senate Bill 783. I want you all to know that Oregon's not the first state to consider doing something like this. There are 10 other states that address the needs of breastfeeding moms in the workplace, and I modeled Senate Bill 783 very closely on enacted legislation from Connecticut, Illinois, Minnesota, California, and Hawaii. I think you guys got a pretty clear message from previous testimony about all the protective powers breastfeeding has for moms and kids. What a lot of people don't realize, the connection folks don't make, is how much it costs when mothers don't breastfeed. For private and public health insurers, it's a minimum of $3.6 billion for our nation every year to treat illnesses that are preventable by breastfeeding. Just for one diagnosis, respiratory syncytial virus, it's $225 million a year. For type 1 diabetes, it's over $1 billion per year. For each baby, the health care cost savings are between $400 and $1,000 in the baby's first year of life. And for employers, that means they pay more in insurance claims to their company health plans, and moms have a lot more absenteeism, and I think some of the other folks that have testified have addressed that. All this information is research-based. I believe that Melissa from Senator Burdick's office made copies of the U.S. Breastfeeding Committee papers on economic benefits of breastfeeding, and that gives all the details and cites the sources for you. People talk to me every day about breastfeeding because it's my job, and I've talked to mothers from every walk of life, all the way from folks who work, you know, doing house cleaning and waitresses to moms who are going back to work full-time as physicians. And they all tell me how hard this is for them and what a big challenge. That they don't necessarily find support in the workplace. We've heard a couple of real positive stories. I'm going to tell you some stories from folks that have had real challenges. I have one friend who works for the University of Oregon in the library. And she kept breastfeeding both of her kids after she came back to work. And her supervisor was real sympathetic with the first baby and gave her the intermittent use of a private office space. And so that went pretty well. But one of her coworkers complained that she was getting special treatment or special privileges. And so then when she came back to work after her second child was born, she lost access to that space to pump. And it made things a lot harder for her. Another friend who's a hospital nurse, and she works in the same hospital where I do, and we actually have some employer accommodation, including a space where everyone can go to pump. She got negative comments in her written performance evaluation every year, after each one of her kids were born, because coworkers complained she spent too much time away from the floor. So it really depends a lot, in the present state of things, on the person's supervisor and on their coworkers. And I'd like to just, you know, remove that uncertainty factor out of it and make it possible for everybody to have access to those resources. Previous question addressed the amount of time that's needed for pumping. That's something that I deal with a whole lot in my work. I'd say it's generally 10 to 15 minutes. And some mothers will have trouble with letdown, and I'd say a lot of others won't. It's just, you know, it really depends. For some people, it's just a mechanical operation, and, you know, they go and empty their breasts, and they're done, and back on the job.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. All right.
Thank you.
We're going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 783, and we will be back in a work session with it when we get some amendments that are coming in, and we will also invite legislative counsel to discuss the issue of expressing milk versus breastfeeding as a relating clause.
We will open a work session on Senate Bill 2004A. And we have five amendments before us. We have 19, 20, 18, 19, 20, 17, and 16. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't let the AOI testify. Would you just come during the public? I'm sorry.
During the work session.
I'm very sorry. I just completely spaced it out.
That's fine.
Yeah, come. Yeah, I'm sorry you had to wait in there. I didn't. I just completely forgot you. Okay. Well, Mr. Gary, you want to come up then? Well, both of you come up. You guys have the amendments here.
I don't want this to even be a picture.
Okay, listen, because you're so uncomfortable, Mr. Glash, but we'll let you speak and then leave. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was out of the room. I did not sign up. I assume we're looking at the amendments on 2004, the dash 17s.
All I'd like you to do is just put on the record what the what your amendment does.
Dash 17s, as I indicated when I had both testified and then ultimately had talked at the last work session in 2004, just sets up a study by the PERS board of mortality tables of specific, and it's more the more traditional police and fire categories. And if they make a determination that the categories described in Section 2 of the section have a life expectancy that's substantially shorter, remember we had a discussion about substantially, what's substantially shorter? I obviously would leave that up to them as far as the administrative rules process, but in my mind it's a year or more, then they would the board will adopt and use separate actuarial equivalency factors for those that are listed in Section 2. And again, Section 2, in trying to construct that, along with legislative council, we went through the more traditional definitions of police and fire. Legislators are not in there. There are some other categories that are not traditional police and fire that are not in there, but that's what it actually does. So it doesn't require them to establish a mortality table, but ask them to do a study, and if they find a substantial difference. As long as we're updating the mortality tables and making them more, correct as far as the general population, we believe that there is a substantial difference on police and fire that is up to 9 years shorter in life expectancy, and we would like to have that correction going in the opposite direction, obviously.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Voitko, do you guys have any comments on this particular amendment?
Thank you, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee. We're more than happy to do this study. The only cautionary note I would add is that for all the years that PERS has been in existence, we have not gotten from employers and have never needed any breakdown of what these people do, the members that Mr. DeLashman is concerned about, only that they're either in PNF or out. So that I just want to say that this will be a from grassroots kind of effort. We'll have to go out, identify employees because their identifiers don't exist in our current records, and perform the study. Is the study impossible to do? No. Will it be more expensive and more detailed and somewhat more time-consuming than something that we can glean from our current databases? Yes, but we'll be happy to conduct it.
Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair, that's why the bill was constructed. Rather than going back and looking at the numbers historically, going back, I did realize that they did not have those identifiers, and that's why it was constructed, that they had until 2005 to do it. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Now you can leave your uncomfortable chair. To the employer representative, welcome, Mr. Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and just for the record, I'm always happy to sit at the witness table with Mr. DeLashman.
He was totally underwhelmed.
I'm here to talk about three amendments, the -17, -18, -19, and -20.
Could you give your name for
amendments?
The record?
And for the record, my name is Bill Gary. I'm an attorney with Harang Long Gary Rudnick. -18 and -19 amendments both deal with the provision of House Bill 2004A that provides for a look back when applying the updated actuarial tables that the bill requires PERS to implement in fairly short order. The -18 amendment simply provides that for an employee who receives a higher benefit than the current mortality tables would provide by virtue of the look-back provision, the look-back benefit is capped at 100% of the member's final salary. The reason for that is to just avoid a situation where current actuarial tables would provide some reduction in the benefit, and the bill provides for an enriched benefit by virtue of the look back. It's our position that the benefit of the look back should in no case result in a member retiring at more than 100% of final salary. Now, the effect of this amendment would not mean that there would be no PERS members who retired at more than 100% of final salary. If a member's benefit under the current mortality tables would still yield a benefit in excess of 100% of final salary, then they would receive that benefit by operation of the current mortality tables. The -19 amendment is a little wordier and maybe perhaps more difficult to fathom, but it is really the amendment that we prepared and submitted to Legislative Council in addressing the issue that at least Senator Minnis at a prior hearing indicated some interest in.
Mr. Gary, just one question back on 18 again.
Okay.
You're making it very clear that the 100% cap only applies to the look back.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
On the -19 amendment, I testified previously on this bill that Judge Lipscomb has ruled that the PERS board under current law is required to use current actuarial tables, and that his ruling was that the PERS board should do so immediately and fully. If Judge Lipscomb's decision is correct, then what that means is that under current law, the use of current mortality tables is required, and then House Bill 2004 becomes actually a step away from what current law requires. And our position in the intent of the -19 amendment is to simply provide that if the Lipscomb decision is upheld ultimately on appeal, then we should get the benefit, that is, employers should receive the benefit of the current law provision that requires current actuarial tables to be used, and so it would eliminate the look back provision with respect to anybody who retires after a final decision is made that upholds Judge Lipscomb's decision. Now, I want to address the Legislative Council's, Mr. Hendricks March 26, 2003 memorandum to Senator Corcoran, whereby he mentions a couple of concerns with regard to these amendments and specifically with regard to the Dash 19 amendments. He suggests that there may be a constitutional problem with a provision that says that a portion of the bill does not become effective or becomes ineffective if the court decides a case in a particular way. And I acknowledge this is a very complicated, difficult area of the law, very technical, and I think Mr. Hendricks did a good job to flag the issue. I also think he did an excellent job of crafting the amendment in order to avoid the problem. Unlike the Coffee case that he cites in his memo or Eccles versus the State of Oregon, which had to do with the transfer of $81 million from Safe Corporation 20 years ago, in both of those cases, the law provided that a particular bill would not become effective unless there was some decision by a court invalidating another law. That's different than what's done here. What's done here is that the Dash 19 amendment provides that in the event that Judge Lipscomb's decision is affirmed, then the PERS board shall calculate benefits in a different way. And I think that is not going to raise the constitutional problem that Mr. Hendricks identifies, but I will confess that I'm not issuing any guarantees, and I don't even have anything close to 100% certainty that the court wouldn't find a problem with it. However, if the court found the Dash 19 amendment to raise the constitutional issue presented by Mr. Hendricks, the only effect of that would be that that amendment would be invalidated, and so the look-back would continue to be applied. We think that from an employer's perspective, it's well worth the risk, in which we think is a relatively small risk, in order to provide an opportunity for the employers to get the full benefit of the Lipscomb decision in the event that it's affirmed on appeal.
But Mr. Gary, the full benefit of Lipscomb is PERS board do it again.
Well, there are two aspects to the Lipscomb decision, Chair Corcoran. One aspect of it is that the board is required to go back and recalculate employer contribution rates, at least for the petitioning employers, because the court has held that they were charging inaccurate, incorrect amounts to employers since 1998, and they have to go back and do that. But the other part of the decision is really a declaration as to what the law provides that affects the way that the PERS board will do its business on a going forward basis. And it's that when I refer to getting the full benefit of the decision, that I'm the Dash 19 amendments are addressed to. With or without the Dash 19 amendments, we believe that we're entitled, if the judgment is affirmed, to have our contribution rates recalculated, but on a going forward basis, House Bill 2004 would institute a look back provision that Judge Lipscomb said is not either present in or required by current law, and it's that the Dash 19 amendments are intending to pick up.
But Mr. Gary, aren't you hamstringing the PERS board in terms of the decision that would then be before them if Lipscomb was upheld, by laying out exactly how they would have to calculate the actuarial equivalency tables?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so.
Says, as soon as possible after the, line 9 down, as soon as possible after the entry of the appellate judgment, the board shall recalculate retirement allowances using actuarial tables that are based on mortality assumptions adopted on September 10, 2002.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the bill provides that the board shall adopt the most current actuarial tables effective on the date that's provided in the bill. I think it's July 1 or January 1 of next year. What But then the bill goes on to say that there will be a look back, and you will calculate the benefit for certain members differently if the effect of applying current mortality tables is to reduce their monthly benefit beyond what it would be if you apply old mortality tables to their account balance as of the date of the effective date of the bill. And all that the Dash 19 amendments does is say that if the appellate court ultimately says that Judge Lipscomb got it right when he said that the court should, that the PERS board should be applying current mortality tables today, period, without a look back, then we'll undo the look back and you'll just apply current mortality tables. That doesn't tie the board's hand any more than House Bill 2004 does, in that it's telling the board to apply current mortality tables, and it's just eliminating a provision that we don't believe is provided for in current law. Judge Lipscomb said wasn't provided in current law, and we're just saying that if Judge Lipscomb's right, there's no reason why you should adopt a look back that has the effect of increasing benefits for members compared to what they're entitled to receive today.
I guess the problem I have with it is that this is a tenuous agreement as we're going through the phases of the current PERS problems and the successor plan, and everybody's been doing a good job. Both employer and union sides have been doing a good job in the negotiations, I think. But what this seems to do is basically give it to you either way. In terms of the look back, that you get to eliminate the look back, which basically has been agreed to by the employer group, if Lipscomb is upheld by this. And I'm a little bit troubled by it because it seems to give one unfair advantage to the employer side in this. But
well, Mr. Chair, obviously the policy choice rests with this body, but I want to make clear two things. Number one, we're not asking for anything other than the application of current law as it has been interpreted by the court, in the event that ultimately the litigation process concludes that that's what current law provides. And our position is that it doesn't make any sense, since the whole purpose of this exercise is to reduce the cost of the public employees retirement system, to add a look back provision unless there is some reason to do it. And the only reason to do it is because it's necessary in order to protect the accrued rights of PERS members. We don't think that it is. Judge Lipscomb has held that it is not. And for that reason, we think that the preferable solution is to simply eliminate the look back. If this body's not prepared to go that far, what I'm saying is at least don't take away from us what we won in the litigation if we're ultimately successful. And I'm not aware of any agreement by anyone that I represent that said that we were okay with the look back that's in House Bill 2004. It was obviously approved by the House Committee, but we've been opposed to the look back from the get-go.
Okay. Senator?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Mr. Geary. It seems to me that what came out of the House, was, as far as the look back, didn't even meet the test of the first coalition group, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, they said you ought to do it differently. The House came back with an alternate proposal, so it's like neither side is really saying that this is the way we should go. And so I guess I kind of agree with Mr. Geary in the sense that you ought not, or we ought not as a legislature, go back and say to employer groups that you can't have the win in the event that the Supreme Court agrees with you. And all this really does is then if the court does not agree with Lipscomb, it affects the legislative compromise. Because neither side is really saying we love this thing. It is, in fact, a legislative compromise. So, I mean, I think it's a very fair way to try to come to resolution on the issue.
I'm looking at it just a little bit differently. I mean, one is that in talking to Representative Knopf about 2004 as it came over and the look-back provision that was in there as it came over, and, I mean, it's an open question whether it was a substantive or a technical change that we made over here. The PERS coalition side will argue that it was, in essence, a technical change because
the PERS staff had alerted them to the fact that the first that the look back on the zero option, I believe it is, was what they considered what the look back provision applied to. The coalition felt that was a technical misunderstanding, and that the look back clearly would have been meant to look back at the survivor options as well. And so whether that was technical or substantive is an open question. And, you know, I understand your point. I guess I'm looking at it that if we're going to put this provision in and then pile on top of this provision the 820s, which create the special master, then I'm not sure that that allowing the courts to decide absent Lipscomb is such a bad idea, because they'll have Lipscomb and the remedy in front of them at the same time.
Oh, right. And all this says is that in the event that the court upholds Lipscomb, then the look back goes away and they apply the actuarial tables.
But it would also eliminate any agreement we made in this building about what that.
But this would be the agreement. I mean, if we include the Dash 19 right. amendment, we would have both as a matter of course. We're right. saying to the court, frankly, we don't know what the answer is. We're trying to act like Solomon and split the baby here. None of the sides agree. We think this is the most appropriate choice. However, comma, in the event that you do agree with Lipscomb, then this would be the path to go. If you did agree, then the first board would be given very specific direction. And I don't agree with you that it just goes back to the existing law. Actually, it adds specific direction outside of just you should update your actuarial tables on a regular basis. So I don't know. I like the amendment. I think it's a good way to go.
Okay. Good way to go. Okay, and do you want to continue then with the 820s?
Yes, the Dash 20 amendment is the judicial review rewrite that addresses some of the, I think, mostly technical problems that I identified in my prior testimony with the current bill. It does, in essence, three or four things. First of all, in subsection 1 of section 5, which describes what challenges will go to the Supreme Court. In the current bill, it provides that any challenge that says that House Bill 2004 is unconstitutional goes to the Supreme Court, but it doesn't provide for a challenge to the bill based upon an alleged breach of contract, which is not in itself a constitutional problem. And you've all heard from the PERS coalition their belief that there is a breach of contract problem with this bill. We just want to make sure that any challenge that is filed considers all of the arguments rather than having a case in circuit court and a case in the Supreme Court. The second change that it makes is to expressly allow participating employers to be heard in the proceeding, and obviously we have an interest, the employers do, in defending House Bill 2004 if it passes, and would like to have the opportunity to participate. As I said before, I think the court has the inherent authority and likely would permit employers to participate. We just want to make it explicit in the bill that the legislature expects that the court will do so. And finally, the clause that you just referred to, Mr. Chair, in a challenge to actuarial tables, it is in particular, but I think with all respect to all of these PERS bills, there is a possibility that there may be factual questions that need to be resolved. Typically, those get resolved in a trial court. Since this is, as a matter of timing, sending the case directly to the Supreme Court, the amendment would authorize the Supreme Court to appoint a special master, probably a circuit judge or a retired judge, to take evidence and then make proposed findings. It's a fairly typical proceeding that is used in original proceedings in the Supreme Court where factual issues need to be resolved. Once again, I think the court has the inherent authority to do so. We're just simply making explicit that is something that they're authorized to do. And then the final change to judicial review is to change the time within which a challenge must be brought. It would provide that any challenge must be brought before August 15th of 2003 rather than January 1 of 2000. and four, and that's simply our interest in moving this along. And as you indicated, Chair Corcoran, we think that the ideal way to get the court's decision on PERS matters is to have the court have before it both the Lipscomb decision that is, in a sense, at least a part of the problem statement, and the legislature's solution to the problem in the form of the various bills that will be coming before you, so that they can look at the entire thing comprehensively and give us, hopefully, an answer that will clear up many of the questions that divide our position from the position of the PERS coalition. We think that this proposed amendment accomplishes that. And I want to address something that that Mr. Hendricks raised in his March 26th memo to the chair, where he said, you know, I'm not sure that you're going to be able to get exclusive jurisdiction in the Supreme Court. And once again, I have to concede that he may be correct, that that ultimately the court will decide that someone can bring a challenge elsewhere. I'm not concerned, as he suggests, that there may not be what is called a justiciable controversy, meaning a real live controversy, because as I've thought through this, I'm fairly satisfied that as soon as this bill passes, a PERS member whose benefit is affected by House Bill 2004 has an injury that they can argue immediately, because the effect, particularly with the look-back provision, is if you've got someone who's ready to retire, eligible to retire, but wants to work for a few more years, the effect of House Bill 2004 would be that for some period of time they would work without any increase in their accrued benefit because of the application of the look-back. And I think that would be enough to satisfy the court that there's a real-life controversy.
Thank you very much. Any questions, panel? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Carey.
Thank you very much.
I've told the PERS Coalition folks that we're not going to move these amendments today because we're going to give Mr. Hartman an opportunity to speak on Wednesday. We'll put these back on for a work session on Wednesday and allow Mr. Hartman to speak, and then we'll see what the will of the committee is. And with that, I'll close the work session on 2004 and open up a work session on 2005. And I believe we have amendments. Who is the author of the A7 amendments? Do we know, Mark? Is it the governor's office? Okay. I don't think there's anybody here from there to speak, so. Sure, why don't you describe what the amendments do then?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we have Amendment 7-A7 for House Bill 2005, which accomplishes, in essence, two objectives. They change the implementation date to September 1 and change the nature under which the members will be appointed, in that the governor will appoint the chair.
Thank you. These amendments are the result of discussions with the governor's office over their concerns about the current PERS board. And I do want to say that I consider 2005 the scapegoating bill. I mean, I really think that the PERS board has, in fact, been characterized negatively for without good reason. I think that they basically, you know, these are all volunteers, 12 of them, incredible workload for a volunteer committee. And so, you know, we're going to let 2005 is going to go through, but I just want to put on the record that that I don't really feel that this should be laid in the lap of the current PERS board, and I'm fine with changing the PERS board if people think that, you know, their behavioral change. I'm also fine with you know, looking at independent counsel for the PERS board so that there isn't any concern with regard to the kind of advice that the current board got. I'm not convinced after talking to the attorneys on both sides in this, and attorneys on every side in this, that there would ever be clear agreement on what would be the most appropriate way to act. So with that, I'll entertain a motion to move the amendment.
So moved.
Okay, Senator Starr moves adoption of the A7 amendments into House Bill 2005. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, I need a motion.
Senator
Walker,
did you approve the motion?
Motion's approved.
Dang, there we go.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to second?
Well,
I wanted to ask.
Sure.
The PERS board has envisioned here, they're not compensated. Did anyone ever discuss the idea of compensating them?
Actually, that discussion now especially has become very strong because the assumption is that you're moving from a 12-person board to a 5-person board, three of whom have to be non-PERS and with some level of expertise in retirement plans. So you're basically looking at investment counselors or you know, retirement plan, God forbid they'd be attorneys, but maybe even attorneys. And, you know, essentially relying on the professional expertise of these people who, you know, and for the most part are either partners or, you know, in their own businesses, and are going to be taking incredible amounts of time off. I know that the way I've heard the PERS board described to me is that there's some real concern about how a five-person board is going to be able to deal with all the committee work that the 12-person board did. They're a very active board. So,
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like to suggest that we hold off on moving this bill.
Okay.
And look at asking and answering that question as to whether or not these persons should be compensated. I agree with you that the board probably has risen a lot of heat that is probably misplaced or misdirected, but it's the only place people seem to know to go to render their frustration and anger. I agree with the bill in concept in the sense that you have five people, because I think that what they didn't teach you at Harvard Business School, since you have more than five, you end up with a less than productive outcome. But I do think if we're going to go to five, which is clear we're going to do, that the folks that are appointed to the board need to have the ability to be involved and be, you know, really connected with what they're doing and the work of the first board. So my assumption is that their salaries, if there were such, would come from the PERS fund.
Let's get Mr. Boyko up to clarify that particular issue, because that's probably the only, you know, we talk about the level of compensation, I presume.
Right. And the only thing I would add is that if we did go this direction, that the PERS board not be beneficiaries of the PERS fund.
Okay.
Be
right.
In some other program. I just think that we really are getting to the point. You're talking about a multi-billion dollar portfolio with a lot of complex material, and we've got people who aren't even given as much compensation as legislators, God forbid, or as much time necessarily to dedicate or concentrate to the work. And I do think it's not appropriate to render our anger and frustration at those folks when we set it up for failure. So
we could give them a lousy defined contribution plan and have them really do good work for us. Mr. Whiteco, come up here, please.
Political comment, I think.
The question, Chair Corcoran, is...
Mr. Voitko, the question is, initially, is are PERS funds available? Would they be available? Would that be an appropriate use of funds to supply some sort of compensation for the PERS board members?
Chair Corcoran,
I should clarify that. The three non PERS, members of the PERS board.
Chair Corcoran, I believe that it would. Their activities are solely in service of the administration of the trust, so using the same test that we apply to our own expenditures, that would be that would seem to be in order.
Could you ballpark for us, Mr. Boydko, as you, you've probably thought through this transition as much as anybody in the building, can you give some sense of what the time commitment of these three members might be looking into the future?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, at present time, the board meets monthly. The board meetings, and we had one this morning, typically run, begin at 8:30 in the morning and run to anywhere from 12 to as late as 4 in the afternoon. It is typical for us to have at least every other month an additional telephonic meeting for urgent matters. In addition, I suspect that on average we would have at least two committee meetings per month, so that while not the full board would attend those, a number of the board members would. Sometimes those are done telephonically. But the real workload is in the massive materials that they have to review before they come to a board meeting. Today, for example, just to give you a flavor, the board book was about that thick, and it contained four contested cases in which the board acts almost like a panel of judges on disability cases or other contested cases. We had a number of rulemakings that were in progress. We had a session, a closed session with attorneys on litigation strategy. It's a pretty heavy workload.
Okay. Well, yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boydko, doesn't the PERS board, though, just really administer the fund, and the Oregon Investment Council does all the investing?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Walker, I'm glad you asked that question, because my suggestion is, and I don't have a policy preference one way or another, that's not my job, and since I'm on the state payroll, I would not benefit, even though I'm a member of the Oregon Investment Council, and even if you did, I would ask to refuse it, because I'm already paid by the state. But if you consider compensation for the PERS board, exactly the same kinds of criteria that Senator Minnis discussed exist for the OIC as well. These are people who are very senior corporate officials or senior investment officials, head of an investment firm, for example, and they also have very substantial workload each month, so that I would say that the issue is somewhat parallel in that respect. Whether or not you choose to link compensation for the two boards together or not, I would recommend that you at least consider it.
And I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
And wouldn't it be, don't you think it would be necessary to have a PERS member on the PERS board so they can deal with customer service issues and account to the membership? They have questions?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Walker, I think that that is a judgment on this body's part as to whether or not a PERS member is best attuned to the mood and the feelings and the sense of service that we give to our members. I hope I'm not too defensive in saying that I hope I and my staff are absolutely committed to delivering the highest level of service, but that's a judgment that you all can render.
I'm not convinced we're going to go back and revisit the composition, but I think the point on the investment was well made. Well, I guess maybe it would make sense to have Legislative Council and Mr. Boydko look at that. It sounds like, you know, 3 to 4 days a month. We could, if it was 4 days a month, that'd be 20% time, so... I guess we could calculate 20% of a mid-level, you know, management position being in that venue. It'd be, you know, pretty much a coin flip, but we could figure out a number if that's what you're wanting to look at.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I want to put an actual number in here. I think that you could almost leave that question up to the Department of Administrative Services or whomever it is that does an analysis of the work and know, of course, the board would be recommending for themselves. That wouldn't be a good idea.
Right.
Would not be a good idea. Well, if you don't mind, can we stew on this for maybe a day or so?
Just absolutely.
Maybe it's not a good idea to even go here, but I just think we're envisioning setting up a five-person board and then requiring a lot of them and giving them a lot of public scrutiny. And, you want to, I think, to be able to attract good quality people to the board.
Yeah,
I'm not sure that you do it that way, so I don't know.
Senator Walker?
Well, and, Senator Minnis brings up a good point, because I wouldn't want to volunteer on this board if I didn't have some vested interest either, if I had all this experience, because you can earn that. You can earn money in the private marketplace doing what the kind of things that you do for the board. But the other issue I think you need to think about is we're trying to save money here, and now all of a sudden you want to spend money.
But it's not general fund money.
Oh. Well, it's not, but it's money.
Senator, you get what you pay for.
Well, absolutely. What do we get paid? But
that's my point. I just don't. Maybe it's not appropriate even here. I just think that you've got volunteers out here who are dedicated, hardworking people, and we're asking them to do more in a very difficult time. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Well, Senator Minnis, you're not the first one that's brought this up. I mean, that discussion's been had in several venues because of the nature of going from 12 to 5, the fact that they're a working board, that they have a lot of issues before them. They have to work on these contested cases, and I think that it's a very, very good idea. We'll sit on it for a while. And Mr. Voitko, if you do you have any other comments to make about either the comments or the amendments, would be happy to hear them.
Chair Corcoran, just to say that I would very much like your permission to work with the governor's appointment staff on this question, just to sound them out, because they're on the front lines of trying to figure out the recruitment process that you talk about, and I would very much like to get their feelings about whether or not some even modest measure of compensation would make a difference in terms of attracting the kind of talent that we need, both on the OIC as well as on the new restructured PERS board, both of which, by the way, will be either exactly or approximately the same size. So, I think the pressure of making sure that we have the best that our state has to offer in this service, whatever is reasonable in your judgment, I'd be happy to pursue this and get back to you.
Well, the problem I have with OIC is that, there's a clear nexus between what the PERS board's doing and PERS administrative funds. I suppose there's an obvious nexus, but I don't know how clear it is in terms of the investment council. I mean, I wouldn't have any problem with it, but I'm just saying that I don't know that I'd want to expand beyond just having the discussion about the PERS board.
That's your judgment, without a question, without a doubt, but I will tell you from a financial point of view, most of the past blow-ups, if you will, in pension history have been caused by mismanagement of the funds. And Oregon has been blessed in that the council has done an extraordinarily good job over many memberships, many chairmen over many years. And it's been one of the reasons why the fund is in as good a shape as it is, given the pressures that we've had.
Yeah, that's very true. Thank you, Mr. Blitko. Okay, we're going to close the work session on 2005. And what do we have before us? 2130?
Yeah.
We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2130, A engrossed. Mark, would you tell us what that bill does?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 2130, A, eliminates the requirement that retired local government employees be charged health insurance premiums in certain categories.
Okay, and we have Gary Pello. Welcome, Mr. Pello.
Thank you. Chair Corcoran and committee members, at the table with me is a representative of the insurance division who will help me with this.
My name is Gary Pello. I am legislative assistant to Representative Backlund, who couldn't be here. He's other places in the building all day.
Probably watching a baseball game.
It could be. House Bill 2130 is a very small change in existing statute, and it's the follow-up of a bill enacted in the 2001 session. In that session, House Bill 2084 was enacted to clear up some confusion in ORS 243.303. That statute said that local government retirees could not be separated from the active employees for health insurance purposes. What was not clear was if they could be separated for rating purposes. In the year 2000, the retirees of Salem-Keizer School District were separated for that purpose. It was discovered that Attorney General opinions concluded that not only could they not be separated, but the premiums they are charged could and should be the same as active employees. So House Bill 2084 addressed that issue. That measure created some confusion, however, that the insurance industry has been struggling with during the past interim. The written testimony that you should have now from Leonard Hagan from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield addresses some of that confusion and why you now have 2130. This measure has no fiscal impact. It merely clarifies the statute and eliminates confusion that the insurers have been having applying 243.303. Be glad to answer any questions.
So, I'm a little confused. The removal in the bill is the remaining sentence simply says retirees cannot be charged higher premiums than active employees. And what confusion did that cause?
Can I defer to a specialist?
Absolutely.
For the record, my name is Maxine McKibben, and I work for the Department of Insurance. The technicality that came into play on current law was the pooling mechanism and the difference between the tier rating and a composite rate. And because of the interpretation or lack of interpretation in current law, the retired people would be charged a tier rate, so the rate would not be the same for the active and retiree. So the purpose of this particular bill here is to make that clarification that whatever rate is used by the public body, either a tier or composite, would be the same for the active and retired members.
Thank you. Was there any opposition to the bill over on the outside?
Yeah. Well, there was just some concern that there was some fiscal. Some question came in about involvement of PERS, and none of that really exists. We're just trying to clarify a problem that came up during the interim because insurers were having such a difficult time interpreting the last sentence that became part of 2084. And when that was added in is at the insistence of a committee member on the House side, it did create a lot of confusion. We were getting all kinds of calls from retirees, people getting ready to retire, being told that this was going to happen to their premiums because of this. And so it had a lot of unintended consequences, and we're just simply trying to finally clean it up.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Good evening.
Senator, from the third minutes.
Your name is what again?
Maxie McKibben.
Maxie, what's the difference between a composite rate and a category? My understanding is right. Category rate and a composite rate.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the difference on a composite rate is the pooling of the entire group of people.
Okay.
And one rate is determined per month per member. So regardless of your status, each person is charged the same rate and is, of course, pays the same rate.
Okay.
On a tier rate, the tier rate is...
Tier rate is the same as the category rate?
Category rate could be the same. I think okay. In the bill it uses the term tier. Category would be of the year family status,
okay.
employee right. spouse, employee family member,
right.
or children. So again, the rate is established per person per month, but then they go into a tier, which is a factor used to determine the right. composite of the family.
Right.
And that will vary
of course.
Composite rate is the entire group pooled together.
Correct.
Okay. Category rate are rates within that larger
after
pool.
It's the second next step down after
okay.
Composite rate.
All right. So, or some subdivision of that whole. Oh, okay. Great. All right. Thank you.
Senator Walker, do you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you asked the question if there was opposition in the House, and I see there were 12 members who voted no.
What party were they?
And they were our party. Mr. Fellow, do you know why there were so many who voted no?
Again, that issue of fiscal came up on the floor of the House.
Okay.
And I think there were some fears that perhaps there was a fiscal involved in this, which there just really isn't. And again, Maxine can address that, but this the change that we're proposing here, and 243-303 in its long-standing history has had really no fiscal impact. And this is just a simple change to help clarify for the insurers as they apply it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2130, and we'll open a work session on 2130. Senator?
I'd like to move House Bill 2130, Negro, before the Senate, unamended.
Senator Menes moves House Bill 2130A and Gross to the floor with a due pass, unamended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Hi.
Vice Chair
Minnis? Hi. Hi. So, we have, lost my paperwork here. House Bill 2130A is passed to the floor with due pass. And do I have any volunteers for this one? Senator Menes will carry it. Thank you very much, Senator. And we are adjourned. Thank you, colleagues. Thank you.